Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
Greetings and welcome to the Intelligent Design the Future podcast. This is Casey Luskin broadcasting with Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture here in Seattle, Washington. And we have with us here in the studio today Dr. William Dembski, a name that is very familiar to anyone who follows Intelligent Design or the ID the Future podcast. He is a leading theorist of the Intelligent Design movement with PhDs in both mathematics and philosophy, and an MDiv from Princeton Theological Seminary, and an author of many leading pro-ID books. So Dr. Dembski, it's wonderful to have you with us in the studio today.
Great to be with you, Casey.
Well, it's exciting to have you on the show with us right now because you have just come out with two brand new books and there's a lot to talk about. So I'd like to talk to you about your new books. Which one would you like to talk about first?
Let's go with Understanding Intelligent Design.
Okay, well, Understanding Intelligent Design is a book geared to help students, or specifically probably Christian students, understand intelligent design. Is that a correct description of the book?
That's right. About 10 years ago, Phil Johnson published a simplification of his Darwin on Trial. It was titled Defeating Darwinism by Opening Minds. And for years, I've been wanting to do a book like that, something that would be geared toward high school students and also really church audiences, Sunday school classes, both adult and junior high and high school. But thing is, I didn't really feel qualified to do that. Whenever I write an intelligent design book, I'm always thinking about what's the other side going to do to try to take it down. And so I had the good fortune of being able to team up with Sean McDowell, Josh McDowell's son. Josh was actually, I've respected and known of for so many years, he actually wrote the foreword to the book. But Sean teaches high school and also has a ministry directed to high school students. And so we teamed up and he really helped make these ideas accessible to a younger audience. And so I'm really optimistic that this is going to take intelligent design and make it clear to a much wider group of people than than certainly my work has appealed to in the past.
Mm. Well, in my job at Discovery, I have a lot of contact with students, many of which are trying to cope with misinformation that their teachers are giving them about ID, or maybe even in some instances persecution that they're experiencing because of their views on ID and evolution. I would like to think that your book is going to be very helpful to them if they're confronted with a teacher who is bashing intelligent design in the classroom, using many of the fallacious common objections to ID. And I think that your book has many easy to use and quite well written rebuttals to these kinds of objections. What are some of the objections that you respond to in Understanding Intelligent Design?
Well, I think they're standard sorts of things. Is it science, the relation between science and religion? Is it creationism, gussied up? And so we make these distinctions. So that's, I think, to situate intelligent design on the intellectual landscape properly. And I think it does that successfully. But the real upshot of the book, I mean, it's to answer three questions. What is it? Why is it important, and what can you do about it? Mm. I really wanted this book to help mobilize young people. Mm. It seems that our hope really is with young people. As people get enculturated, entrenched in secular ways of doing things, especially when people go on to graduate school in the sciences, unless they're prepared, unless they're inoculated against materialistic ideology, which is so pervasive there, it seems that they're easily swept away. And so this was really to try to put young people in a situation where they give them the tools where they could combat a lot of what they're going to be facing in high school, college, and then also in graduate school. We have at the book closes actually, and there's some appendixes, but the close of the book proper ends with 10 things people can do, and the very last recommendation is that they get a PhD, help us do the heavy lifting.
Something you can just do in your spare time, I guess. What are some of the other action items that you give to students or readers of this book?
Well, I think one thing is give time and money. And I mean, money is certainly important because all the federal funding is going toward to the evolutionary side. But time is very important also. Mm. If there's a school board meeting, or if they're meetings to consider textbooks, and the evolutionary side is represented, is the intelligent design side going to be represented? Writing op-eds, opinion pieces, mm-hmm. in newspapers, inviting speakers, teaching the book in a Sunday school class, getting yourself informed, how to inform yourself. I mean, this book, I think, is really just the start. We have in various appendixes which help people to get their feet further wet in this. So we have DVDs they can look at, websites, books, questions to ask their high school teachers about intelligent design. So there are lots of resources there.
And I'm obligated to throw in the caveat here that if you are going to go talk to a school board, come talk to us at Discovery Institute first. We have lots of experience dealing with people who want to go talk to school boards all around the United States. We can give you all kinds of materials, information for how you can go in there and deal with that effectively. You left off what I actually think are two of my favorite action items, Dr. Dembski, one of which was to go and get involved with a blog and go do pro-ID blogging, which I know there's ample opportunities on your blog, Uncommon Dissent, to go and even just go participate and leave comments and that sort of thing.
Well, that's right. I mean, the internet is a wild and woolly place, and it's there are lots of opportunities to influence people with that. And it's a very interactive environment. So you get stuff up, it's there, lots of people can look at it, and then people give you feedback on it instantaneously. There's some nasty characters on the internet also, and you may want to, if you're just starting on this, to go with some experienced hands. But I think certainly making use of the internet, I'm not sure where we'd be in the intelligent design movement if the internet wasn't there, because the traditional means of disseminating information seem to be very much still in the control of the Darwinists.
Very true. And you know, one thing that any young student who wants to get involved with internet blogging should think about is what do they want to do with their career? I think that a student who wants to go off and have a big career in grad school, if they're pro-intelligent design, you know, may not want to go around on the internet supporting intelligent design a whole lot, because someday their name's going to get Googled by an admission counselor at some university, and that may factor negatively, if they're out there publicly supporting intelligent design. Now, on the other hand, you can always just be a lurker on these websites. You can just watch the debates. You can follow them. You know, occasionally put in your two cents without getting too involved. So I think there are ways for young students to do this without, you know, and I'd always add, you know, make sure that whatever you say, remain respectful, and, you know, make sure that you can back up what you're saying, and you'll be able to defend anything you did on the internet these days. So would you agree with that advice?
Yeah, I would. And certainly another option is to use a pseudonym. I mean, now the thing is they're pitfalls there as well, because I think it can become a temptation just to hide behind a false identity. But if it's done simply to protect yourself and to keep you in the game, as it were, for so that you can finish your graduate studies or your undergraduate without getting nailed by by some rabid atheist professor or committee, I think it's something to do. But it's something I would caution, because there are temptations also there, as I said, to hide behind your internet persona, and then if people do find out who you are, you don't want to do anything that's going to get people to think, well, you've been deceiving us all these years.
Yes.
So there are things to watch there, but it's there are lots of options in dealing with the internet.
Yeah, if you do use a pseudonym, you should probably never say anything that you wouldn't say if it was your real name. You know.
Yeah, I think that's my advice. I mean, when you're on the internet or doing emails, you know, you think you're sending an email to somebody and ends up with somebody else. You think it's confidential. You know, everything that you do on the internet is likely to become just public knowledge and you know, be associated with your name, and Google hits are going to find what you said.
Yep, and if we sometimes use the test of, if you wouldn't want it to be printed on the front page of the New York Times, then you probably shouldn't say it. So, because it just, you know, that wouldn't happen, but it still might become public. The final action item that you give is something that I'm partisan to, which is starting an idea club. And I appreciate the fact that your book mentions that. And obviously, I've had a lot of involvement with that. And I think that's another great thing that students can do. So how many pages is Understanding Intelligent Design approximately?
The book itself, the main body of the book is about 180, 190 pages, and then there are five appendixes there, okay. Which then expand it out. So I think the publisher listed at 240. So, but it's I think a pretty quick read. There's sidebars in there. It's I think very user friendly.
It's very user friendly. I've read bits and pieces of it. I've just got it recently, and I want to finish reading it. But I can say that it's clearly something that's easily accessible, and I would recommend it to any high school student, probably even middle school students as well.
I think junior high can handle
it. Yeah, absolutely, who are interested in this issue. And surprisingly, this is a niche that I don't think has really been filled very well yet in the ID movement. So thank you, Dr. Demski, for creating a book that I think is accessible to students of many different ages on ID.
Good.
Let's talk about your other book, which may not be quite as accessible to the average junior high student, but is nonetheless very interesting. It's called The Patristic Understanding of Creation. If the title doesn't speak for itself, why don't you explain to our listeners what is this book about?
Right. Well, it's the subtitle is An Anthology of Writings by the Church Fathers on Creation and Design. So I think that makes it a bit clearer.
Okay.
But what we did, this is a long project to finally get it all together, but it's about 600 pages where we've gone through the writings of the Church Fathers. These were the theologians of the Church from the really usually second century, so the century after Christ, to about the 7th century. And so you've got such luminaries as Augustine in there. You've got the Cappadocian fathers. But all of these great theologians, they thought deeply about creation and what it meant for God to create. And there were a lot of challenges to creation in the ancient world. I mean, a very popular view among the ancient Greeks was that the world was eternal. And so they would respond to these various objections. Mm. And some of the discussion there actually has a very modern feel. But the book arose out of a controversy about 10 years ago, in which Howard Van Til was trying to co-opt the some of the Church Fathers to say that basically when God created, he gave creation all the capacities it would need to do its own further creating, as it were. So in a sense, he was saying that that the Church Fathers, or at least some of them, were endorsing an evolutionary view in which no further intelligence was, as it were, required. So that's where this volume arose. So we a lot of the writings are drawn from the standard volumes on the Church Fathers. So this was public domain, but so we had to actually get quite a few writings also, which were more recent translations, and there was a fair amount of work that had to be done getting the copyrights
wow.
on this. So it's I think a very nice collection where you get you've got more obscure figures. I think Theophilus of Antioch, but you got the Cappadocian fathers. You have Augustine, Gregory of Nazianzus, Origen. So just a real, I think Maximus at the end there. And then there's a wonderful essay by Father Florovsky that closes it, which really he was an Orthodox theologian who as it were recapitulates so much of what was in the previous writings. So it's I think a great collection. If you want to know what the early church thought about creation and design, this pulls it all together.
Wow. And it sounds like the contributors are fairly diverse and ecumenical in their background. Is that right?
When you say the contributors, I mean, they're the editors. There's three
editors. Okay.
So there's me, there's Wayne Downs, and there's Father Justin Frederick.
Okay.
Father Frederick is an Orthodox priest in the Dallas area. Wayne Downs is a Baylor grad in theology from their seminary, and I teach at Southwestern Seminary.
Okay.
So there's a bit of diversity there.
Okay. Yeah. Well, let me put it to you straight. Would the Church Fathers, if they were alive today, lean towards an intelligent design view of origins or a theistic evolution view of origins?
I'd say they'd go very much on the intelligent design side. I mean, they were very much into God's hands-on creating things. I mean, you even get an interventionism that's there. But it's yeah, I mean, the idea that the world is completely dependent on God and God's creative activity. I mean, in fact, there's some wonderful metaphors there about God's relation to the world, and I think they're much more effective than Paley's watchmaker metaphor of the world is a watch and then God is this mechanic. It's one metaphor that comes up, and you'll see it if you read the volume, is God as a musician who makes the world as a musical instrument and then plays it.
Okay.
And this interaction of God playing, you know, the world, as it were, as a musical instrument. I think it's I think a much better analogy for God's interaction with the world, or metaphor, than the mechanical analogy. Because you see, the perfect machine is one that once you make it, it should operate on its own, never need further intervention. I mean, a perfect watch would keep perfect time, and you'd never need to get in there and tinker with it, just reset it or whatever. But the perfect musical instrument is not one that plays itself. It's one that has a consummate artist who plays it. And so it gives you a different window on the whole creation issue than what you would get from early modern science and the Enlightenment.
Very interesting. So it's the Patristic Understanding of Creation. It's not a short book. You won't read it all in one night.
But you don't need to read it all. It's one that you read by dipping through.
Absolutely.
It and finding the authors that interest you, and they're little bio sketches for each of the church fathers. So it's I think that which clues you in on what's happening.
Well, this sounds like a contribution of great value to this entire debate. So thank you very much for putting this together as well. Any other projects you're working on or things that are in the pipeline that you can talk about right now?
Yeah, I mean, there's several things I'm doing with Bob Marks of Expelled fame. He's a professor at Baylor University, and so we continue to write some papers and have some under submission. So once those get accepted, I think that'll be big news in the intelligent design world, because I think bit by bit, all the challenges that have been put forward against the intelligent design movement, I mean, I've watched this over the years, you know, no peer-reviewed publications. Well, you know, we've done that. Your stuff isn't being cited in the peer-reviewed literature. Well, that's happened. But then really nailing down the mathematics that I've been developing in a way that is publishable in a standard information theory or engineering journal. I think I think we'll see that in the next few months. Some of these no free lunch conservation of information results. So I think that's coming up soon. There's a book I did last year called The Design of Life with Jonathan Wells. And we've taken, the book as a whole is a critique of evolutionary theory and then a discussion of intelligent design and some of the latest ideas about it. But the last chapter is on the origin of life. And the thing is, that is such a slam dunk, even if you think evolutionary theory has it all down and everything that we've said in the book up to that point is wrong. This chapter, I think, just completely nails it, that materialistic approaches to the origin of life have just utterly failed. And so we've spun that off. That chapter, which is a very hefty chapter, is about 30,000 words. We've spun it off into a standalone book, which we're calling How to Be an Intellectually Fulfilled Atheist or Not. and the reason for that title is Richard Dawkins, in his book The Blind Watchmaker, writes that Darwin made it possible to be an intellectually fulfilled atheist. The thing is, Darwin didn't address the origin of life problem. I mean, he did touch on it, but basically he thought that it was a very easily solved problem, because the difference between inorganic matter and living forms, in his view, were very close. I mean, there's the idea of life, single cellular life spontaneously generating from non-life was for him not a big problem.
Yeah.
But now we know that with the revolution in molecular biology and our understanding of the cell, that the cell is incredibly complicated, that basically what we're looking at there is an automated city with all of our best technologies represented inside the cell. So the origin of life problem is one that Darwin didn't touch, And until you solve that problem, it seems to us you cannot really be an intellectually fulfilled atheist, because if, certainly not by appealing to Darwin, because Darwin needs the origin of life for his theory. I mean, his theory has to presuppose that. So anyway, it's a fun book. We've basically reorganized, rewritten this chapter. Got a great quote by Teddy Roosevelt in which he remarks that that science can be even more superstitious than religion, because the thing is, the scientists think that they're doing in superstition, but when they lose track of what they're really doing and accept things uncritically, then they're even worse than any of the superstition of religion. So anyway, that's the epigraph to the book. And Anthony Flew, actually, he's given a wonderful endorsement of The Design of Life, where he says, if you've read Richard Dawkins, you know, and you've bought all this, now read the other side by reading The Design of Life. And we're able to use that actually on the cover also of How to Be a Fulfilled Atheist.
That's great. Well, this sounds like a very fun project.
Yeah.
And sounds like it'll be a great way for people to learn about this one topic. I mean, The Design of Life is an amazing book. There's a lot of material in there. So this is one way to get bite-sized pieces of it, perhaps.
Right. So that should be coming out October. And then the idea is ISI Books, which is publishing it, will tie that in with the release of the DVD for Expelled.
Okay. Oh, so great.
That's the hope.
Well, that's very exciting. Well, thank you for all your great work and for talking to us about these exciting projects you've been working on.
Well, thank you. And thank you, Casey, for all that you do for our movement.
Well, we all are having a lot of fun here. This is Casey Luskin with the ID the Future podcast signing off. Thanks for listening.
Hello, I'm Bruce Chapman, president of Discovery Institute. The ID the Future podcast you just heard is a crucial part of the mission of the Center for Science and Culture, crucial to keeping you, our friends and supporters, informed about developments in the debate over intelligent design and evolution. Podcasts like Intelligent Design don't just come about through an unguided process or an unfunded process. That's why I'd like to ask you to help support us in whatever way you can. Please consider donating to Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture at discovery.org/CSC. You can also help support us by forwarding this podcast to family and friends and by posting links to intelligentdesign.org and discovery.org on your websites and homepages. Whatever you do, we appreciate it. Thank you.
Music on ID the Future comes courtesy of composer Yuri Mamchur. Visit www.yuriproductions.com and check out his latest CD, In the Harbor. This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. Discovery President is Bruce Chapman. ID the Future Managing Editor is Robert Crowther. And the producer is Keith Bennett. ID the Future and ID Science in the News is copyright Discovery Institute 2006. For more information, visit www.discovery.org or www.idthefuture.com.